maybe, somehow had led them to practice those kinds of behaviors. So I'm sort of dancing around your question, because they're, we don't know why they are the way they are, but each one of us is different. And they are just a little more different when it comes to the specific performance of certain behaviors, which then lead to outcomes that are fun. For instance, and we did some work, actually doing a lot of work in hospitals, with using the positive deviance methodology for the prevention of hospital-acquired infections. That's a very big public health issue here in the United States. Much under the radar, the 3.5 million hospital-acquired infections. These are infections that come down. I mean, science is there. We've known this science for 200 years, that anti-hygiene, gloving, and gowning. But adherence rates in any hospital, you'd be lucky if they're over 30-35%, which basically means that every time you have a physical encounter with a healthcare provider in a hospital, chances are 2 out of 3, there is risk of infection transfer. 3.5 million hospital-acquired infections, 100,000 deaths. That's more deaths than breast cancer, HIV/AIDS, and road accidents combined. So while we are doing work with hospitals, you realize that there's a nurse on a certain unit, 4 East, you know, hospitals are 4 East and 2 West, who, for some strange reason, carries a Purell poster, which is clipped to her body, which means that she carries her hand hygiene with her. Now, what makes her do so is a terrific question. But she's not the norm. And so there's much to learn from her. There are people whom we found, and for instance, we found the knuckles. What does she do? She doesn't use her thumb, which is what most of us use to press the elevator button. You can imagine the elevator button as being a vector of infection transmission. And there have been studies which have been done that show that using your knuckle as opposed to your thumb reduces infection transfer to contact by 95%. So small little behavioral things, wisdom already existing, which has led to drastic reductions in MRSA infections once this wisdom was amplified. So the question really is, what's the motivation to use the knuckle, or what's the motivation to carry the holster? And they do it because it makes sense to them. And then can we take that wisdom, which is hidden, which is lurking beneath the surface, and find a way to amplify it? Because then if they only solution, they are also very mindful of the problem. And if they only problem, I guess they're mindful of the solution. So it's a terrific question.
I'll make the long question so you can take some bites. Do you think that we will eventually find out that they are such as the innovators, early doctors, early warriors of diffusion? Do you think that we will find that they do have some personality differences, some communication behavior differences, some socioeconomic differences? Or do you think it's just almost, like random acts of smartness?
Yeah, clearly you can systematize these, or you can try to systematize these random acts of smartness. I think that's very well put. Oftentimes, you're not even aware that you're doing that. And I haven't completely wrapped my head around how we take a categorization or a systematization process such as what Everett Rogers had proposed in Diffusion of Innovations and really apply it to the positive deviance methodology. Because in many ways, these are, one thing with positive deviance is you're always dealing with the worst case scenario. you're dealing with households where you expect them to not be doing things, which they do. And the rationale is that if the worst case scenario, people who are in the doldrums can do it, then everybody can do it. So that's a very different kind of a person in terms of profile than, let's say, the innovators.
No, who are sort of especially like super innovators.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. But I'd say I haven't completely wrapped my head around it. That's okay. It would be interesting. There's very little scholarly work on positive behavior. There's none. There's very little. And there's some studies that have been done in nutrition. And as I said, when I stumbled upon it, I said, gee, this is something which can serve all of us well, because it's a different way of thinking. And so we are now trying to systematize it. And the case studies that we have and some of the other work we've done, we're actually coming out with a publication. First book, actually two books in the works. One is Positive Deviance, Good for Your Health. And that's basically an assessment of hospitals in the US, six or seven hospitals that have done a phenomenal job of reducing MRSA infections by 90 to 95%. When in the last 10 years, MRSA is a type of it's bad bacteria, antibiotic resistant. Whereas in the past 10 years, MRSA infection rates in the US have quintupled 5 times. And these hospitals, last 2 years, down by 95%. So, and that's big chunks of money. Every extra infection in a hospital costs the hospital a lot of money. Often not reimbursed because it's hospital acquired. Yeah. So.
And people happen to be dying too.
Of course, there's the human cost. Which is, and you suffer.
No? When you go to the hospital,
right.
You
do that well. And run to.
Take some nights. Questions.
The three examples you used last night, main examples, were iconic figures at a time when the mass media was limited to maybe two or three primary sources. In the West, we had such a wide dispersal of media and messages. I'm not sure even an iconic figure, unless living by example, can have that kind of effect. Is there a danger that in the developing world there's also going to be with satellite internet and others? Such a wide dispersal of media messages, that window might be closing to where you could have that great of an effect on an entire country, the way Mandela did.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, with Nelson Mandela and World Cup rugby final, you've got all the ingredients in terms of captive audience. And there, you've got 70,000 people in location at the Ellis Park Stadium, and the world sort of watching you. Although what happened in Vietnam probably is in sharp contrast to what happened in South Africa. And clearly, I think as media markets get more and more saturated, and yet at the same time more and more fragmented. The possibilities as well as the challenges, I think, continue to expand.
But just newer opportunities or different ones.
Exactly, yeah. But it also means that, for instance, Unload, the television soap opera, in 1984, 85, 25 years ago in India had ratings of 90%. Now, that would be impossible today. The top shows have ratings of 15%. If one just looked at that metric, we know that there are other options now. And so from a viewer's perspective, that's good, because they can now choose to, watch or engage with whatever media that they may want to. But for people who are interested in showing an issue and, raising debate, that's probably not such a good thing. But it also offers them other media channels, the new ones. So I think it's both fragmentation and expansion of opportunities at the same time.
We can talk about these for a second. The idea that mass media, diffusion has shown us that, the diffusion research has shown us that the mass media channels are great for helping people become aware, maybe forming a favorable or unfavorable attitude about it. But they're not that great at leading people to decide that what mass media channels tend to do is bring it to awareness, bring it to discussion. But it's the kicking in of the interpersonal channels. So really mass media is the wedge that gets you and I talking. And that's where the decision, am I correct, Doug?
Yeah, that I think is in this particular age, even in the Facebook age and YouTube age, they still need somebody to make a decision. We might be aware of an issue, and we have all the knowledge surrounding that issue, but when it comes to buying the product or implementing an idea, getting something, maybe you see the iPhone and you want to buy the iPhone, but if your friend has an iPhone and you talk to that friend, and then you say, you get convinced. So the interpersonal channels, you know, Ever Rogers was very, very focused on how, first of all, media is very powerful to spread the message out. But then when it comes to the decision, innovation decision issue, adding interpersonal channels are still found to be strong enough. And we oftentimes fail to use them. We are very good at disseminating the message because we have all these opportunities in terms of many channels available now, mass media channels, but many campaigns, public health campaigns and other campaigns, they fail to cash in on the interpersonal channels, and that's a challenge.
But that's where the real action is oftentimes.
I may actually address that somewhat differently, or rather pose it as a challenge to us. So then the challenge really becomes, having heard what Steve has said and Avinash has commented on with respect to media being good at awareness and, maybe some predisposition and attitudes, and then it's the interpersonal channels that are magic. So the challenge then becomes, how do you create a type of media, let's call it intervention, which spurs conversation? Can you do that? And I think that's a very important question to ask. And soap operas. The reason why soap operas, as we've seen, are so powerful as not just carriers or disseminators of health information, but also a little more than that, is because they have all the narrative qualities which hook us, which keep us engaged over time. Different characters, different situations, lots of buzz. Is he going to sleep with her or not? Are they going to be safe or not? And those kinds of questions. So when the magic really begins once you switch off the TV set. So the challenge for us really is, how do you let the media message work harder for you when it's not even working? Because we know the value of mediated and interpersonal layer communication. So how do we make it more sticky, I guess?
And that's a book I think Jeff is reading right now, and I've got on my shelf. The sticky, what is it, the stickiness factor?
Make stick.
Make stick.
One thing that Avinash also mentioned, or said, that it made me think, when you mentioned the BlackBerry, I believe,
Apple iPhone. He carries an iPhone, so.
Oh, but the iPhone is in diffusion. There's five attributes of all innovations, and one of them is. you said last night, when a neighbor sees their neighbor's kid bouncing around all healthy, they're like, what happened? What are you doing? You know, or remember in the old days when satellite dishes were 25 feet in diameter, it's hard to miss those. You know, and so when your neighbor has one out in West Texas, you're going to stop by and say, what's that in your yard? And so those sort of things spur only these conversations that then that person who has that becomes a self person, in essence. Am I correct?
Maybe it helps other people to decide because they can trust this person, they know this person very well. And the space that is created, you know, I mean, soap operas or other universal towns we have, it creates a space to talk and exchange views about this thing, and then what did you like, what did you not like, and how to get a bouncy job. And in that spread, the innovation, the critical mass,
yes,
is achieved after these kind of conversations start happening. And soap operas kind of do a wonderful job. After you switch off the television,
right,
that's where the S-curve starts shooting up because people start talking about it.
And of course, it's got to be good. I mean, it's got to have some racing plots in order to, as we said, good romance. And the idea is that, you know, that's your hook. I mean, you need people to watch for anything.
That's one thing you've said in your book that I picked up on is that it can't be poor quality productions. That just is unacceptable. People will turn my attention. I don't care. It has, and that it, and these things are not mutually exclusive. You know, quality productions and good entertainment and a social message.
Right.
You don't have to choose.
And once again, it's because we have our compass pointing in certain ways, and you know, often there's this notion that you've got to morally degrade a message in order to boost its ratings. And yeah, maybe that's one way of doing it, but you know, you can pose the question the other way too. Can you actually enhance the message to boost its ratings? And our experience suggests that yes, that is possible.
It seems to me that social decisions are made through interaction with social networks. And is the reason that soap operas and the television dramas, those kinds of things, are effective is because there are characters with whom the audience member identifies.
Yes.
Either they feel like they're like that person or they want to be like that person. And so really that is what's affecting that decision-making process.
Yeah.
Is that the reason?
Yes. Identification is key. We also talk about this notion of parasocial interaction. You know, it's almost like when I remember when Peter Jennings, ABC anchor, is still around. Every evening at 6:30, no matter where I was, I would try to switch on my TV set and welcome Peter into my living room or in my hotel room. And it was almost like I had a date with Peter Jennings. You know? It's like, hello, Peter. How are you today?
Were you ever jealous?
Yeah. Or with Ted Koppel, or with you know, whoever else. It's you, in essence, and this is a very interesting phenomenon. We engage with media characters often in a way as if the media screen did not exist. It's almost like being with a friend. 6:30 every evening, I'm going to see you know whoever. And likewise with soap operas. 8:30 p.m. every Thursday. Gee, I welcome these characters into my home, and we talk to them. We feel as if there's no. And you know, some people have called this phenomenon very interesting phenomenon, parasocial interaction, because you think it's the seemingly interpersonal relationship between a media consumer and a media character. So when Michael Jordan was with the Bulls and our 16-year-old Michael on? No? Yeah! Go, Michael, go, as if he's listening. So it's the seemingly interpersonal relationship between a consumer and a media character, but that's one way. It's not reciprocal. But we think it's reciprocal. And that's a very, very powerful form of engagement. So when Maria, as a maid, was, let's say, not being treated well by her employers, you felt for Maria. And if she was crying, you'd say, oh, Maria, it would be okay. No. But you can also take that notion of parasocial interaction and extend, if you may, the level of audience engagement. So when Maestro Esteban, her literacy teacher, for instance, leans over Maria as he's helping her with her homework, and you can hear Maria's breath, no, sort of picking up a little, you can tell Maria, no? Hey, Maria is a good man, no? He's a good man. Yeah, get a little closer. Get a little closer. So it's the audience know a lot of things which the characters may not. So Maria may not know that Maestro Esteban really likes her because he's talking about this with his friends in the bar on TV. And Maria is talking with her friends saying, oh, he's such a good man. But they don't share that together. So you're saying, gee, come on, go out, you guys. And it's that kind of mediation. It's that kind of involvement and engagement which leads to, I think, stronger effects.
Am I correct in what you've written that people do, I mean, you all have seen and recorded people talking to the TVs.
Oh, yeah. We all do it. We all do it. We all do it. We all talk. It's like, even if you say, you know, some, you know, or whatever, no, it's like you're talking to.
Something brought up last night was about the one of the negative, potential negatives of EE, which is the Cinderella effect, and how some, after Simple Minute Maria, found out, I bought a singer-song machine. I did this. Why am I not cheating the results? And so we have to be careful with that.
One has to be. Ultimately, it really is the viewer or the listener who decides. I mean, it's a fairly democratic process in that you are making choices. You're making choices. Do I bring these characters into, you know, my fold every evening or not? And even if I do bring them in, then what do I do with it? The doing is with the viewer. And sometimes maybe the doing doesn't work out to be what we would all consider as being a desirable thing. But they are doing it because they think that's what they should be doing. So one has to be careful. But what do you do about Archie Bunker, for instance? No? Archie Bunker, All in the Family, created by Norman Lear in the early 70s. And the idea was to confront issues of racial prejudice. And Archie was created, was parodied by Lear through a narrative format to basically bring to the fore, you know, prejudice so that people would talk about it and so on and so forth. And there were, you know, 2% of the audience which would sit whenever Archie would come on TV in front of their TV sets, and, you know, when Archie would use some of his choicest words, racial epithets and you name it, they would cheer him on, no? They'd say, oh, way to go, Archie, yeah! No, sock it in! And clearly, that wasn't Lear's intention by the time. But
it became called the Archie Bunker
effect. Exactly.
And then Scattershot, is that the same?
Oh, that's right, Scattershot. why need to talk about scattershot speed? Scattershot, just think about the name, no? So this is a Jamaican character whose name is Scattershot. Would you guess that he's very popular with
him?
And he likes to scatter his seed? So yes, so you know, there are several listeners who are listening and saying, yeah, scattershot, go for it. Cheering.
The producers were trying to show him as, don't do this.
Anything.
And they were like, yes, I want to be like him.
Yeah. But ultimately, I mean, that's a decision that lies with the consumer, as is the decision to change life by, you know, Coca-Cola or a cigarette or whatever else. So, so I don't think one can. I mean, it's ultimately a very democratic process, unless you're being told that, and you have no choice, either to watch or not watch, or to do or not do.
But I think the good part of it is it gets the people talking about the Asian Fish Diet or, you know, other health issues that they have, and then over a long period of time, you know, human rationality people. They get its way, and people who are engaging in these kind of acts would ultimately say, well, no, this is not the way to go. So I think the good part is, for me, it feels like it at least gets people talking. It was hidden under the carpet somewhere. Most of these issues, like Chris Dye, not talking about it.
Taboo topics.
So first of all, the good thing is you get them talking. It comes to the surface. And then, oh, it takes a more amount of time, less amount of time in some cases. But overall, ultimately, enough people say that it's not the right way to do things, and people find some sense in that.
See,
go ahead, please.
This brings me back, in a way, in my little mind here, to the ceiling effect that you discussed last time, which I found almost as fascinating as the positive thinking. That where you have a situation that needs to be rectified, and you have some wisdom in that situation that's already doing something positive about it, and yet their neighbors are not getting it.
Right.
And even when you amplify it, they don't get it. I mean, a certain amount of people do, up to a point.
Right.
And even with EP, it multiplies it even further, but what I heard you saying is that despite your best efforts, there will always be people in the culture. It's going to sound like I'm rambling here, but I think...
I do that a lot.
I think I'm going to come out at a question. I'm not sure exactly what my question is going to be when I get there, but it's going to have something to do with religion and all of this. We, from a Christian worldview, tend to paint things in terms of a struggle of good and evil, with the ultimate good being God, this personal God, and ultimate evil being this personalized what we call Satan. And when I was listening to you talk about that ceiling last night, I'm thinking, what's the problem? Why wouldn't everyone go out and get those shrimp? Why wouldn't everyone go out and get the sweet potatoes? Once they see this working, why is that ceiling there? And then, you know, going back to this discussion, for our worldview, at least as I perceive it today, there is this negative force. There is this spirit that is, Sherwood Lingerfelder called it, cultures are a prison, a cultural prison.
Right.
Where, and he relates it to the temptation of Christ, where Satan takes Christ up onto a mountain and offers him to all the kingdoms of the world in their splendor.
Right.
And then he says, these splendid kingdoms, despite all the beauty of the culture, you know, there are so many positive things in our culture, and yet at the same time we are imprisoned by it because we cannot see past a certain point in this culture. And then you add to this negative forces that glorifies a man who is basically a pervert or a racist,
of course.
And so I guess my question is, and unfortunately religions don't always help. And even Christianity becomes part of the problem instead of part of the solution. And so I guess what I'm trying to zero in on is some sort of question about, have you seen the role of religion either helping or hurting or both, or can you see religion as a powerful force in conjunction with doing good or perhaps doing evil?
Yes, once again, I think the answer is, if there are any, to questions that you propose are lurking in the question that you posed. EE is a tool, if you may.
It's a tool.
It's an approach.
For good or for evil.
And, how, if there's the purposive use of it, how one wishes to use it, for what end, of course you can't guarantee what the end would be, because the ultimate choice, if there is a choice, lies with the consumer. So it really is, it's a method of engagement, it's a method by way of which you use narrativity or qualities of narrativities to create conversations and actions that don't happen. And what direction do they go? One has very little control over, given that the ultimate choice, the decision, is. But that's not to say that that it can't inspire, that it can't encourage, that it can't motivate people. If you believe in goodness, I'm not going to use the word God, but let's say if you believe in goodness, and this engagement can tap into that reservoir of what we consider as being good, as opposed to the reservoir of what we consider as being not so good, then the potential of it as a tool clearly gets magnified. Not just in terms of more adult literacy learners or more people who let's say have a less violent relationship with their partners, but also in terms of the basic values, whether it's forgiveness or kindness or tolerance or other things which we consider as being good or godly.
Taking a step further, it looks to me, in listening to you and listening to the E formulas that you've delved into, that maybe one of the first instances of this being used were in the parables, such as the Good Samaritan.
Absolutely.
Where you're basically putting up an entertaining story.
Absolutely.
With an agenda inside that hopefully people relate to and change the behavior of 10% of the people who listen.
Well said. Absolutely. And E is not a new idea. It's been around. We know the value of the stories from the Bible. In India, we grew up with stories from the Panch Tantra. And the Panch Tantra, five characters, and those have been around for 2,000 years. Or we read the epic poems, the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, and there are characters who exemplify certain virtues or certain vices, and we make sense of them collectively, and have done so historically. So yes, sir. That's an excellent point. It's all around us, but the purposive use in a media setting is a relatively, you can say, new phenomenon. With a method, using the research to distill the messages with respect to domestic violence, and then putting it in a format so that more conversation can. But it's been the ideas have been around.
It is apparent that you are leaving a legacy to me, that the studies you've done and the impact that you've had on Tampa's, all of us want to live our lives to be meaningful and our work to count for others, and to leave our generation much better than we have. It would be wonderful to know what you would like to do and to leave.
Good question. comment and grace the underlying that comment. So the question is, what next?
Please.
And Anuja knows this, I live not too much in the past and not too much in what's next, but a lot in the now. So the focus is the here, the now, let me be, or let me challenge myself to be the best that I can be with all my foibles and weaknesses in the moment. The next then takes care of itself for me. I have firmly believed that, you know, and I don't know if it was Littman who said this, but somebody said, and it doesn't matter who said it, because I think what was said is useful, that you can judge in many ways the quality or the health of a nation by judging the quality or the health of its public discourse. And I think on that count, I'm very inclined to agree with you that the quality of the public discourse, the quality of the mediated discourse is very, very poor, I believe, in this country where we, in general, say that, you know, free world and we can voice whatever we want to say, but there's really not much plurality. If you're not with us, you're against us. I mean, that's shutting discourses. That's closing conversations as opposed to opening them. And oftentimes, then you find yourself in situations where we end up in a state without really having any sense of how we got there and now what should we do with it. So I think that's a point to be reinforced. And so there is tremendous value, I think, in dissension, in disagreement, in debate, in dialogue. And, you know, maybe there's even room for, let's say, people who are at the extreme, you know, whether it's Rush, Limbaugh, or maybe there is some room, provided there are other discourses as well that are happening so that people can make somewhat more informed choices than be swayed, if you may, by the passion of, you know, the influentials and both extremes. So the more kinds of discourses we have, I think, the better it is from a consumer's point of view. I'm using a marketing term, but you know, we're all consumers of information, whether it's in a church or in a university or wherever. And I would like at least our boys to know opposed to, you know, gee, this is the way it is and this is the way it should be, or there's some value in that. So having said that, then, if indeed we are dealing with fighting the battles, not just on the ground, but fighting the battles in the minds and heart of people, I think there's a tremendous potential, untapped, for using the media in ways that appeals to the minds and hearts, as opposed to, you know, the battles that we fight with. You know, we may ask ourselves, we have so many colleges where we learn the art of warfare. You know, we've got West Point, and we've got, you know, whatever else. And, you know, how many colleges are there where we learn the art of peace? You know, where do we learn that? Do we even teach courses? And what do we do, you know, inherently in our own... So the potential is there, and we have so many movies, you know, Rambos and Terminators and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, once in a while you have a, you know, a Gandhi or, you know, a movie about, well, Invictus, Mandela, Schindler's List, and so on and so forth. So I think the field is really wide open. There are people, there are organizations that are trying to use narratives as a way of healing. There's radio soap operas in Rwanda and Burundi, countries that have, there's an organization called Search for Common Ground, which uses soap operas. Soap operas actually centered around soccer. Because in soccer, you don't really care about whether you're a Tutsi or a Hutu, if you're playing for the Rwandan team, no? Or if you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Druze or a whatever, if you're playing for Lebanon. No? So using narratives that are based on sports in order to bring about notions of working together, and each one having a goal, you know, whether you're a goalkeeper or a striker, or a defender, or a, you know, whatever.
They all just want the ball.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. So the possibilities are immense. I think we just very, very early tapped into that. We could do more.
We're going to hack in either now or next Friday. And so I think we need to probably end now. A couple things. I brought some more copies last night of